Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Danny Sims wrote to me all about his observations in Fiji over several years, and it was a very interesting perspective. And I thought, hey, you know what? Let's get Danny on the show and share it with you all. Danny's on the line now, and he joins me. Welcome to The Crunch, Danny.
Thank you, Cam. Glad to be here.
So you wrote me a letter, and it was about cruising in your yacht in Fiji in the winters following Bainimarama's takeover.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about that.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting time. I was stuck in Fiji this particularly in 2012 when I had some trouble on my yacht, and we had to get some repairs done at Vunda Point by an outfit called Baobab Marine. They did a great job for me, but in that time, I got to know the local people quite well. I mixed with them, mingled with them, and we had a lot of conversations. So, it was fairly front of mind stuff with Bainimarama in those days. And the New Zealand media and the Australian media and the respective governments were vilifying him and calling him all sorts of nasty names. And so I was interested to find out what the locals thought of him. Mm. And all I know is what they told me. I have made no opinions of my own. I didn't try to concoct anything. I just listened to these people and I've sort of got a bit of an outline of what went on.
Yeah, well, so this is in 2006, 2007, you were up there?
No, the Bainimarama took over in 2006. We were up there one of the times. We'd been there before, but the time where I got all this information was 2012.
Oh, right. So quite a few years later and before the 2014 election. So people had a good chance to have a look at Frank Bainimarama and see what they thought.
Yeah. Yeah. There were some really important things that he did. And for a start, the government of the day was going to pass some legislation which was very along the lines of our Foreshore and Seabed Act in New Zealand.
That was far worse than that, though.
Which was going to give one group a lot more advantages than another group. And the population of Fiji is split around about 50-50, it was then, of ethnic Fijians and Indian population who are descended from those who were brought in as indentured laborers during the British rule in India, and a variety of other immigrants. So it's just about a 50-50 split. And this legislation was going to give the ethnic Fijians considerable advantage over the others. And anyway, the way the story was told to me was that Bainimarama was in Parliament, and he said to the Prime Minister, "Prime Minister, if you pass this legislation, I'm taking over tomorrow." One of his aides leaned over to him and whispered in his ear, "Tomorrow is the annual rugby match between the police and the army."
Yep.
And without any hesitation, Bainimarama looked up and said, "If you do this, I'm taking it over on Monday."
Yeah, that's one of the most popular rugby matches in Fiji, the army versus police. The other one is the school's final, which I actually went to the rugby with Frank Bainimarama to watch one of those schoolboy games, and I've never seen a more brutal game of rugby in my life.
That'll be right. Now, the Fijians live for rugby. They're just absolutely nuts on it, even more so than us.
Yeah, but you're quite right, because Lysenia Ingarase was in power, and he was utterly corrupt. And this is the problem, the perennial problem that they have in Fiji is corruption. But Ingarase's proposal was to basically confiscate private land and then give it to Itaukai.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was all coastal land that we were talking about. Now, naturally, that affects all of the resorts. It affects all of the hotels. They're all on the coast. There's nothing in the highlands that's remotely valuable or anything like that. It was all designed there to depossess people who owned property on the foreshore and then to take that into Itaukai control. And you're absolutely right. Frank Bainimarama did say to Ingarase, "If you do that, I'm going to take over." And Ingarase, of course, did do that. And we saw the 2006 coup. which removed him from power. But the interesting thing is he also, once he took over, is he effectively cancelled the Great Council of Chiefs.
Yeah, but I'd like to run through the stuff that I've actually made some notes.
Yeah.
So there are a number of things that he did that I think were worth me just running through. This is what the people told me. He sacked the judiciary because they were corrupt.
Yeah.
And the New Zealand and Australian governments and press shrieked, evil man, he sacked the judiciary. He sacked them because they were corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
He set up a commission to write a new constitution. And he told them, you'll give me one man, one vote, all equal, and I will sack you.
Yep.
So they didn't, so he sacked them. So he set up another commission, and he told them again, you will give me a constitution with one man, one vote, all equal, I will sack you. And they didn't give him equal, so he sacked them. And, of course, the New Zealand press and our governments went ballistic and shrieked, evil man, evil dictator, sacking his constitution committee. He set up a third one, and he told them also, one man, one vote, all equal, or I'll sack you. Well, they gave him one man, one vote in the Constitution. I've read through it, and I can find the clauses that say that. And so he didn't sack them, so they got the new Constitution.
Mm, that's right. And you mentioned about him saying, I'll take over on Monday. On the Sunday, he took the troops from Victoria Barracks for a run. And there's a video of it. You can find it on YouTube. It's highly amusing. There's Frank Bainimarama jogging with his troops through the streets of Suva from Victoria Barracks and sort of down along the waterfront and up through the main street of Suva and back again. And, of course, the media in New Zealand wrote that up as Bainimarama flexing his muscles. Well, he was, of course, doing that. But then when he did take over, we had that awful Barbara Dreva from Radio New Zealand, who wasn't even in Fiji at the time, who did some news stories about it, about the coup, and she described it as the Fiji army under the dictator Bainimarama has put tanks on the streets of Suva. Now, that's been scrubbed from Radio New Zealand's archives. You can't find it if you try. And I think it was also on TVNZ. You can't find it. But she said it. And so consequently, Bainimarama said, well, you can't come here anymore because you don't tell the truth. And of course, she screeched about that. But the ironic thing is there were no tanks on the streets in Suva because quite simply, is the Fiji army doesn't have any tanks. I mean, the best armoured vehicle that they've got is like a mine-proof vehicle, called an MRAP. But most of them are overseas and very few of them are in Fiji.
Anyway, just going down my little list.
Sure.
Corruption was rife. It wasn't just the judiciary; it was right throughout the whole country was corruption, and we were astounded in 2012 to see signs on the side of the road saying, "If you see corruption, ring me," with Bainimarama's personal cell phone number. That's how seriously he took it. Ethnic Fijians were really exploiting the Fiji Indian population. A taxi driver told me before Bainimarama, if he had an ethnic Fijian passenger after dark, he never got paid. And similar things happened in shops. And once Bainimarama came along, there was no more trouble. And then the shops themselves used to be a little bit shonky in the way they did business. And after Bainimarama, they didn't dare because the Fiji police were quite abrupt and their jails aren't that comfortable. And Bainimarama made use of them to shake out the corruption.
Yeah, the Fiji prison service is quite interesting. If you don't have a relative who will bring you food each day, you don't get any.
Yeah.
It's very basic. The old Suva prison, which was just around the corner, you know, in Lamy there, around the corner from the offices of the Fiji Sun, was a brutal prison, an awful place that you – but you'd see at lunchtime about 11 o'clock people lining up and they had food and supplies for their loved ones who were in prison. And it is look, justice in Fiji is often very rough.
Yep.
I remember when some years after the original coup of Bainimarama, there was three sort of rapists that had escaped from Suva prison and then spent the following week marauding their way around various different suburbs of Suva. And eventually they were caught. But what the police did is they handcuffed these guys and chucked them in the back of the ute because the police will drive utes with open trays on them, chucked these guys in the back of the ute with a spare tire that was loose and then proceeded to drive around the streets of Suva which at that stage were pretty bad, leaving them all battered and bruised by this roaming spare tire that kept bouncing around the place. And then they would pull up in the communities at these, and they'd raped some grandmothers and assaulted people and all of that sort of thing. And then the police would pull up in those streets, and they would get these prisoners out and handcuff them around a power pole. And then they would say to one of the locals, "Oh, we just need to have a cup of tea to get your statement for what these guys did," and leave them there. And of course, everyone in the suburb would then come out and give them a hiding. And that was all before they went back to prison.
It was it was not a place to get into. Other things that the man did, a lot of children didn't go to school before him because they couldn't afford the school bus fare. Mm-hmm. And so he made free school buses.
Yep.
There was a hydroelectric station up in the hills above Nandi and been there for years. The village had been told if they gave the land to the for the scheme, they would get free power. The scheme was built, but the free power never happened over many, many years until Bainimarama took over and they got their free power. Roads were a total mess, and you just mentioned those Suva roads and those guys getting bounced around, and he fixed them. Now, I don't know where he got the money to fix them. Could have been China, could have been anywhere. But anyway, the roads were fixed. That's what the people told me. The new constitution stripped the Great Council of Chiefs of all their power.
Yep.
They ceased to function. They had considerable power over government. Under Bainimarama, that stopped. He delayed elections, and the press and governments in New Zealand and Australia shrieked, "Dictator." And given the scope and depth of his reforms, he had no choice. He had to bed them in before an election was held. And when it was held, Bainimarama won by a colossal landslide.
Yeah. Just touching on the Great Council of Chiefs, this is the hilarious thing about the Great Council of Chiefs, right, is the New Zealand media and Australian media in particular write about Fiji all the time, and they talk about this travesty that Frank Bainimarama had disestablished by decree in March 2012, the Great Council of Chiefs. And this was awful. This was how Fiji was governed before the British came. Of course, that's not true, right? The Great Council of Chiefs was actually a colonial construction, an artifice that Sir Arthur Gordon, who was the governor of Fiji at the time in 1876, decided that he would set up this Great Council of Chiefs, and that's how they would govern the colony's indigenous population. So it wasn't how they actually operated before the British turned it into a colony. It was a construction of the British colonial government at the time in order to give the appearance that they were controlling the Itaukai population via the Great Council of Chiefs. And of course, anybody who knows anything about Fiji is that the Ratus, or the chiefs, are actually just a basic title that really doesn't mean anything, because the great power in Fiji is vested in women, and the land and tribal land and the passing on of that land is via the female line of families, not through a chief or a ratu, as they're called in Fiji. So here was this system that was put in place by the British to control the Fijians, and the New Zealand media and the Australian media always talk about this is awful, it's taking away the rights of Fijians. They were rights that were given to them by the British in the first place.
I had a very interesting occasion. We were invited to the celebration of the Independence Day, which is just quite an important event in Fiji. Yep. And we were invited to the Bisisi village. And it was a huge honor because it's a very significant day. And we had to carefully follow all the protocols as to where we sat, where you could walk and where you could sit.
Yep.
It was a large village and would have had strong links to the Great Council of Chiefs. After the ceremony, I joined a group of elders on the porch of a house talking about a variety of things. And to be welcomed to that group was a pretty, really honoring, because we'd lived in the area for so long, months, but we'd interacted with the community. We'd become a part of their community almost. And anyway, because I was aware that this village was a significant village and quite likely had pretty tight ties to the Great Council of Chiefs, I was interested in how they thought Bainimarama had gone. So I asked them, I said, "Well, what do you think of Bainimarama? Now, here we are 6 years into his rule." Mm-hmm. And they said, "Well, we were worried. We watched him. And we have made our minds up. And we think that he's very good for Fiji."
I mean, there was an amazing transformation in the 6 years from the coup till 2012. And even in the following 2 years in 2014, when democracy was returned to Fiji. Now, I was up in Fiji in 2012, and I hadn't been there for quite some time. And I was astonished in 2012 just how run down, particularly the roads. I mean, the preferred method of transport in Fiji for those who can afford it is four-wheel drives. And there's a reason for that, because they have potholes that will swallow a small car. But what I saw in 2012 was a positiveness that was coming out of the population. And it was equal as well. The population of Itaukai that were seeing that the country improved, services were improving, those sorts of things. And the Indian population, who felt they were finally getting a fair go for the amount of work and effort that they put into, you know, basically running most of the businesses and keeping everything running. But it was astonishing to see the improvement. And I asked Frank Bainimarama how that came about. And he says, oh, it was very simple. He said, when we took over in the coup in 2006, and you have to remember too that coups in Fiji are rather gentlemanly the way they do them. The exception, of course, was George Speight's coup in 2000. But they generally don't have any ammunition in their rifles. They block about three or four streets. They take control of the bridge at Lamy and on the other side of Suva, and control entrance into and out of Suva. And the government sector is a small little area, and they basically take control of that and then say, right, now we've changed our government. But Bainimarama said what they did is they found that all of the councils in all of the cities and towns around Fiji were kind of ineffective. They didn't even do the basics right. They didn't clear away rubbish. They didn't make sure the water worked. They didn't clear drains. They didn't do all the things that a council should be doing. So what he did is he said, right, well, this town here, that's got, you know, 5,000 people, we'll put a captain in charge of that. And this town here, that's got 10,000 people, we'll put a major in charge of that. So he sacked all the councils, put in the army with the troops of the captain or the major or whatever, and then set about making sure that the councils worked. And, of course, everybody was happy with this because the rubbish was being collected, the water was working, and the essential services that had been run down and dilapidated was suddenly being fixed by these strapping, burly soldiers that were not brooking any nonsense at the same time. And the same thing happened in Law and Order. He put the army in charge of the police department, and they set about knocking a few people on the head and sorting out the crime problem. And you ask anybody in Fiji what it's like during a coup, and they say, oh, it's great, there's no crime. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, you know, my overriding thoughts of this thing that I just read out to you and described was, why on earth New Zealand and Australia and the governments and press were shrieking at him, because he's doing what needed to be done. You know, and in New Zealand, we're going the other way, and we have gone the other way, and we are now in a fairly dire situation because we haven't followed that sort of pattern.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. That's the great travesty, really, of how New Zealand and Australia treated Fiji. And it's hurt the Fijians. Like, the people I know up there that I talk to all the time, they talk about the betrayal of Fiji by Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, that absolutely.
Instead of assisting them to return to democracy, they decided to go to war with Frank Bainimarama. And you know, the reasons for his coup were honourable. The reasons really? For his coup were to get rid of corruption. Now, it didn't kind of, like, he had, was in power for a long time and, you know, won two elections and then lost the third election, but only just. You know, still, the Fiji First was still the major party, but a lot of things improved. But between 2012 and 2014, when I went back to Fiji after 2 years, the changes were astonishing. You had brand new shopping centres.
Yeah.
You had brand new roads from the airport. You know, I don't know if you've ever flown into Nausori Airport, which is Suva's main airport. It's a very, very short runway, and the road was appalling, you know, and people didn't like doing it. But they improved that, and they're working on extending the runway now. So all of these things happened under Bainimarama. Again, I don't know how he paid for them, whether the Chinese paid, but I asked him about that. I said, well, what about the Chinese paying for this? And he says, oh, yes, but you know, everyone thinks that we're selling out to the Chinese. But when push comes to shove, if they get a bit stroppy, then we'll just deport them and keep what they've spent their money on.
So that's the beauty of his style. There's no nonsense. He just deals to them as they have to be done. So, one of the things that I noted about the people, you know, being among them for that time, is they at 2012 and the subsequent years I was there after that, they were proud of the country. They were proud of what they'd achieved. And one thing I noticed was when there's a disaster and all the trees fall down and roofs are ripped off and so on, they just get stuck in and fix it.
Yeah.
No, they don't wait for someone else to come and do it. They get out there with their axes and their handsaws and whatever else they need to do it, and they just deal to it. And I think they're an impressive people.
Well, you know, you're right about that pride, especially when it comes to things like football or rugby. You know, I was in Fiji at the time that the Fijians won the gold medal at the Olympics in the sevens. And they made $7 banknotes and issued coins as well for that victory. And it was astonishing just how many Fijians were running around trying to get hold of a $7 Fiji banknote to commemorate that. But watching that game live in the GPH in Suva, it was just amazing. And then the party afterwards, it carried on for 2 days. The pride of Fiji to win a gold medal at the Olympics was incredible, just incredible.
Yeah.
And Fijians are proud. Yeah, Fijians are proud of their country. And like, I was born in Fiji, and I'm proud of the country I was born in. And one thing that Frank Bainimarama did that was very positive, he said, anybody who was born in Fiji is a Fijian.
That was the big thing.
Yeah. There's no more I Te Ao Kai. There's no more Indian. There's no more Vulangi. There's no more of this nonsense. If you're born in Fiji, you are a Fijian by birth. Yep. It is your right to be called a Fijian.
From his constitution, declare that we are all Fijians united by common and equal citizenry.
Yeah. Now, wouldn't that be wonderful if we saw that in New Zealand?
Well, you know, as I said, even way back then when things weren't as bad as they are in New Zealand now, but we could see the seeds were being sown, I thought to myself, this guy's doing what we need.
He is. But, you know, but like all politicians, the wheels fell off a bit towards the end with Frank Bainimarama. I mean, I got on really well with him. I even had a game of touch rugby with him and his bodyguards one day. I was driving past the USP and I saw some people playing on the football field and I thought, oh, that's Frank Bainimarama. Oh, no, I'll park the car and get out. Well, next minute he comes over, Cam, come on, play. You play against me. And one of his bodyguards says, you got to know the rules, bro. The rules are don't tackle the boss. So we played touch rugby for an hour or so. I was absolutely knackered. And here's this guy, the Prime Minister of Fiji, running around on the field with soldiers and keeping up with them. I was knackered.
He was a big man too. He was a big man.
Yeah, but that's how accessible he was to the people of Fiji. Now,
well, he came in. And he saw it needed to be done, and he dealt to it in every area.
Exactly. You know, if you look at his attorney general, that's a different story altogether. Now, I got on pretty well with Ayaz Sayed Kayyum, reasonably well. Went to a rugby match with him too. I think it was Queen Vic versus another school. And he, of course, was an old boy of Queen Vic. But he went and sat in the stand in the midst of the other people just so that, you know, he could be seen with those people to show that there's no hard feelings. This is a football match. But unfortunately, Bainimarama came to rely more and more and more upon Ayaz Sayed Kayyum. And unfortunately, him and his father and his brother had different designs on the economy for Fiji than perhaps what people were hoping for.
Yeah.
He's still got an iron grip over the Fiji First Party, and it's a terrible shame because my experience of him and interacting with him is not as pleasant as it was with Frank Bainimarama, let's say.
Yeah. we had just on a subsequent visit, there'd been a major cyclone gone through and flattened. It was one village was blown off the planet. It just disappeared from the top of the hill down into the gully, and it didn't exist anymore. And we loaded the boat up before we left New Zealand with, I thought, what do they need? They're hammers and hand saws and nails and all sorts of practical stuff. So we loaded the boat up with all this stuff and took it with us. And then we hired a car and we drove around. We looked for villages that were in trouble. We stopped and handed out all this stuff. And that was, but, you know, they were really happy to receive hand saws and hammers. And that's what they need to put it back together again.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that in villages too. It doesn't take a lot of money to make a big difference in places like Fiji, particularly in the villages. But that had been used in the past by corrupt politicians. Because after Bainimarama took over, he conducted an investigation into the Electoral Commission and replaced everybody in the Electoral Commission, conducted this investigation about the last election that had elected Ngarase as the Prime Minister, of which he removed him. And they found some appalling situations that had occurred during the election campaign where you had the Methodist Church that was involving itself in politics. And they were facilitating the handing out of either tractors or outboard motors, depending on where the village was located. If they were in the highlands, they got a tractor, and if they were on the coast, they got outboard engines. And the proviso was to vote for Ngarase's government. Of course, what happened is they ran out of tractors, but had plenty of outboard motors, and ended up giving outboard motors to some of these remote villages in the highlands of Fiji. On Viti Levu.
Only the Methodists would do that.
Right. So that's one example. You had one electorate that had 28 registered voters in that electorate, and yet 427 votes were cast for Ngarase's party.
Yeah.
You had a situation where the Methodist Church was restuffing the ballot boxes. And so one of the innovations with the Fiji electoral office when they were created under Bainimarama was that all ballot boxes in the voting booths would be transparent. You know, we've got cardboard ones here in New Zealand, right? And this is what cracks me up, right? We lord it over Fiji and we say, you know, you need to do what we do because we're not corrupt. Well, I say bullshit to that. In Fiji, they decided what you're going to do now is we're going to have these plastic bins with a slot in it, and there'll be a seal on those bins. And when the polling booth opens and the first person comes in, they can see that bin for taking the votes is empty. And the only way you can put anything into that bin is for people to cast their vote. And this is the other thing they did. They made everybody have a voter ID card. Not like our Easy Vote card, right, which is mailed out. You actually had to apply for it, and it would have a photo on it, and it would have your fingerprint on it as well. And people were driving around Fiji in the 2014 election with purple fingers from the fingerprint. And they were proud of being able to vote, and they showed that. But also they said, well, you live in this area, so this is the polling booth that you can go to. And here's the role for that polling booth, and no one else is allowed to vote there.
Yeah.
Right? So it tightly controlled the count. It tightly controlled the transparency of the elections. It did slow it down a little bit, but you know, that was funny. In 2014, in that election, I was up there for it, and the count was coming in very slow, and I got a phone call and said, Cam, can you come down to the TV station? We need you as a guest to go on TV. I said, oh, why do you need me? He says, oh, we just need you to talk about stuff, anything, it'll do. You can talk about anything. Just get on there. We just need to keep people occupied. So I go down there and get ushered into the studio. Well, I was in the studio for 3.5 hours talking, you know, with ad breaks. And then they just said, no, stay here. Keep going. And we're talking. And then I saw Bainimarama come into the studio. And then they had an ad break, and he came and said, oh, we've just about got the count sorted out. So, you know, thanks for that. But I've just tell the people to be patient, to stay by the grog bowl, and, you know, we'll have an answer shortly. So here I was on Fijian television telling everybody who was watching the thing that, you know, I've got a message from the Prime Minister. He says stay by the grog bowl and stay calm and we'll have a result soon. And half an hour later there was. But yeah, that's how it worked in Fiji.
I just want to drop back to the beginning of when what Franco was facing when he did his coup. After the 2000 coup, a lot of the land leases that were the Indian farmers had the land leases for growing the sugarcane.
Yeah.
And most of those leases were lost after the 2000 coup. And I guess it hadn't improved by the time that Frank took over. But the Indian population were leaving in droves.
Yes.
And they were the people who were doing the stuff.
Yeah, most of the exodus.
He had some serious issues to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, when you had Rambuka's first two coups, they were very vehemently pro Itaukai and against Indians. And you saw a mass exodus of the best and brightest from Fiji after Rambuka's two coups. And of course, you had Speight having his rather nasty coup and the only coup actually where shots were fired. And Frank Bainimarama during that 2000 coup was actually being hunted down by Speight's henchmen and members of the army that had mutinied. And he had actually crawled out of the Victoria barracks in a drain. And so that's why he always called, Speight, it refused to name him, would say he's going to stay in prison and die there. And it's also why he also, what he called Rambuka the snake. Because Rambuka was part and parcel of some of the excesses that went on under his coups. Rambuka went around and campaigned at the last election and prostrated himself before the population and apologized and said that he was wrong to have done his two coups in the way that he did them, and that he was going to stick with the constitution and all those things. Of course, subsequently, He's gone back on all of that,
and is
actually acting almost like a dictator again, albeit with a one vote majority in the parliament.
I heard that he'd got back in again, well, poor old Fiji, you're going back to where you were.
Well, I was willing to give. It takes a little bit of something of somebody for them to apologise for things they did in the past, and I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'd seen how the Bainimarama government had lost its way, and maybe an election was the way to sort that out. But I'm pretty sure from my talking to people up in Fiji that they actually now would fondly like Frank Bainimarama back as the prime minister, and let's not have Sitiveni Rambuka as the prime minister anymore, because he's bringing back the Great Council of Chiefs.
Yep.
He's sacked a whole lot of civil servants, because they're the wrong sort of civil servant. They're not Itaukai. They're either European or Indian. And he's got a policy of populating all of the judges and all of the government institutions with Itaukai. And there's been a real clearing out of the civil service with no improvements, of course, in service.
You must be understanding and seeing parallels in New Zealand.
Oh, absolutely. This is what staggers me is I saw under Bainimarama a refusal to engage in race-based politics.
Yep.
Everyone in the country who was born here is a Fijian.
Yep.
And that's my view on New Zealand, and it was my view being brought up in New Zealand.
Yours and mine too.
Right. And
that man was doing a really good job.
Yeah.
And all we could do was abuse him.
Yeah, and we treated them shabbily, and then we wonder why Fiji turned its back on Australia and New Zealand and decided to become a member of the non-aligned movement, which is filled with a bunch of ratbag countries like Iran and China and India and things like that. We did that, not them.
Yep.
We did it. We made them feel like second-class citizens in their own home, and we turned the Fijians against mainly Australians. Australians are not well-liked in Fiji, just quietly. Kiwis are much better liked, but political Kiwis are not liked at all unless they're Winston Peters. But that's because he sits down and talks with them, practicing talanoa, respectful discourse, and not lecturing them.
Yeah.
Again, it gives me a cause to think about when John Key decided he was going to go to Fiji and fly into Suva. Well, clearly hadn't been informed. The only way that he was going to take a 757. Well, 757s can't land at Suva Airport at Nasori. So he ended up. Well, that's too short. The runway's too short.
I know, that could have an interesting outcome.
So he went up there in a clapped out Hercules, and then he arrived at the airport and then taken to a function to welcome him to the country. He had a speech all there, and I was given a copy of Bainimarama's speech ahead of time so I could publish it on my website. And Bainimarama just gave John Key a kicking that he'll never forget about how New Zealand had been a poor friend to Fiji, that they had, we had to have the coup because we had to remove corruption. And it just listed all of the things and said, and your government opposed all of this. You didn't like all of this. And so that's where it went from there. Of course, Helen Clark hated Bainimarama. So he had a dislike for New Zealand politicians. But Winston Peters and Shane Jones, when he was the fisheries commissioner, they really enjoyed the confidence of the Fijians and still do.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. It was a fascinating time for me to be up there, and it was quite humbling to be welcomed as I was and told the sort of stuff I was by the people really speaking their hearts to me. So it was great.
But that's the thing, Danny. That was my experience. I fondly remember the 2014 election. Now, it's funny because the 2014 election in Fiji was ahead of the New Zealand 2014 election. And I was in Fiji to cover that. And there was all these New Zealand journalists running around trying to find out where Frank was or where
the corruption was, looking for the corruption.
No, but they were trying to interview him and do all of this. Now, I would just text him and say, hey, whereabouts are you? And he'd say, oh, I'm at my place. Come round. Right, so I was up at the Prime Minister's residence drinking kava with the Prime Minister while the New Zealand media were running around trying to find him. And they were doing stand-ups outside the pavilion that's in the park opposite the GPH, the rugby pavilion, because that's where they were told that he was going to appear once the results were known. He had no intention of appearing there once the results were known. If they had bothered, they would have found that out, but they didn't, because they stood there giving false impressions about what was going on. And that's why I got you on the show, because you actually spoke to people in Fiji. You got anecdotal evidence on how people felt.
Yeah.
You spoke to cab drivers. You spoke to people in the villages. And that's what the journalists don't actually do.
Yeah.
You know, they don't do that in Fiji. They go up there with their own prejudices about Fiji, stand there and lecture the Fijians about how you should act and behave, and then wonder why they get banned from coming to Fiji. And as Bainimarama said to me about Barbara Drevis, well, she just tells lies, so she can't come here.
No, that's really sad. And I just repeat myself to say that what I saw there looked like a blueprint for New Zealand, that we needed to sort things out. And you're just talking about the councils and how they you put a captain or a major or a colonel in charge of different communities. And wouldn't that help us?
Well, it would. But I look at New Zealand and where we're heading, and, after 6 years of the Ardern-Hipkins regime, race relations are a worse state than they ever have been in New Zealand.
They certainly
are. And we've got this radical Maori separatist rabble that are pushing an agenda. And, only this week they've been, promising to protest and grind the streets to a halt with their process to remove a colonialist government. Well, it's ironic that they're using a colonialist invention called the motor car to do it, but that's what they're saying they're going
to
do.
Not to mention the roads.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're on Instagram and they're making statements. This is Rawiri Waititi's wife, who is John Tamahiri's daughter. She's on there talking about revolution, talking about usurping the government, about removing the government from power, and that they have enough power themselves to be able to take over. That's all insurrectionist and violent behavior, and the media are cheering them on. There's no
treason.
Well, it used to be called treason, but that's exactly what they want to do. There's this belief that Maori before the arrival of Europeans was this nirvana-type society where everyone lived in peace and harmony and looked after the environment and everything was fantastic. Of course, the reality of the situation was there were warring tribes at each other's throat with an average age expectancy of 35, living in cold, drafty huts with mud floors.
There's a book written by one of Hongi Hika's descendants. It's called Hongi Hika, Warrior Chief. If anyone wants to dispel any false notions they have about the pre-European New Zealand, they need to read that book.
Well, I mean, you know, Hongi Hika, a few years before the treaty was signed in 1840, took a war party down to Coromandel and took 2,000 slaves and marched them back to Ngāpuhi territory. And of course, in 1840, he was dead by 1840, but his son-in-law, Hongi Hika, signed the treaty. And in the treaty, of course, it promises the chiefs all of their possessions to be retained, which, of course, included slavery, the slaves that they had. But we're not allowed to say that. We're not allowed to discuss that anymore because that's not the heroic fairy tale of Maori society that we are allowed to know. You know, they tell us something different, and we're shoved that's shoved down our throat all the time. So, yeah, I think we could learn from what Frank Bainimarama did in between 2006 and 2014. Certainly having a written constitution would be helpful because we don't.
But, you know, if we had a written constitution, how it would be written, and well, it would be a shocking document.
I imagine it would be an appalling document written by academics and wombles.
Yep.
That wouldn't say anything, and you could drive a truck through the gaps in it.
So very scary. So well, anyway, that was my experience in Fiji. It was a wonderful place to be. I enjoyed it immensely. I'm not going there now at these days because of a variety of reasons, but I certainly enjoyed it when I did go there. And it was great to be taken into the confidence of the people the way we were.
The Fijian people are very accommodating to tourists, particularly from New Zealand. And all we have to do is sit down with them and practice the Fijian or Pacific concept of talanoa, that's, you know, having discourse with respect, and you'll find that they'll become your friends.
Yeah.
And Fiji's a wonderful place. It's the place of my birth. When I get off the plane in Suva, you know, I actually feel, it's really strange, I get this feeling that I'm home.
Yeah.
Even though I've lived the majority of my life in New Zealand, Fiji is home for me. A number of my friends here in Auckland were born in Fiji at a similar time to me as well. We're all Kaivitis. And, you know, it's a wonderful place, and I think that New Zealanders could learn from that, particularly around this concept of one person, one vote, and that everybody is as a New Zealander because they're born here, not for any other reason. There's no preferred race or anything like that.
There was a tourism advertisement from Fiji years ago now, and they showed the beautiful water and the palm trees and the little islands, and it said, Fiji, the way the world should be.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's been a fascinating chat, and I'm glad that you wrote me that letter, and it's good for the listeners to actually get to have a say sometimes rather than just via an email or a letter.
Yeah. I really appreciate talking to you, Cam, as I had this information I got from the people, and it's fairly, compared with what is the consumption in New Zealand of what went on, it was so radically different. I wondered if I really had it right, but I was sure I had. And to hear you confirming it all, I've been very, very pleased to hear it all confirmed. I wasn't running down the wrong path. I actually did have it nailed.
No, you did have it nailed. That was the feeling, the overriding feeling that I picked up, you know, when I was visiting between, 2010 and 2018 is the last time I was in Fiji. That was just before my stroke. So that was the feeling I had. It was a very positive place that was finally growing, finally stepping out of the coup culture. But sadly, the election went a different way, and they've ended up with Rambuka and his bunch of fellow travellers who are decidedly racist and I don't believe they've got the best interests of Fijians at heart.
What you've told me about the replacement of the staff with ethnic Fijians rather than the people who are doing the job, it just shows that corruption is going to be rife again. It can't help it.
A classic example is the former director of he's been suspended by the Rambuka government, Christopher Pride. He's a New Zealander, and, you know, interestingly, Christopher Pride was on a blacklist from New Zealand because they considered him to be part of the regime of Bainimarama. And so for a number of years, he was marooned in Fiji because he couldn't even come back to his own country. But anyway, he was the director of public prosecutions. Rambuka came in. They suspended him for the high crime of being at an embassy function and having a photograph taken of him talking to the former Attorney General, Ayers Sayed Kayum. That was his high crime to be suspended. They replaced him with a guy who cannot hold the position of Director of Public Prosecution because that's a constitutional position that's outlined in the Constitution. That person cannot have ever had any sort of professional standards complaints upheld against him. He's got numerous complaints against him from the Law Society, and yet he's the acting Director of Public Prosecutions. He's also the man that was involved in prosecuting Frank Bainimarama. So there's questions that's going to have to be taken to the Supreme Court in Fiji over the prosecution of Frank Bainimarama by a person who shouldn't have even been in the job in the first place.
I have no knowledge of what is Bainimarama was convicted of or why he was convicted, but I have just an instinctive feel that it was a kangaroo court. I just don't believe that what I knew of Frank and what he did, that he could have done what they say he did.
It was a kangaroo court on trumped up charges, yep. You know, not dissimilar to what's happening to Trump. But yep. He's now in Nambooro prison, ironically in the same prison as George Speight for a year. Yep. So, but I imagine there's going to be some fallout from that. We'll just have to wait and see. But Danny, it's been a pleasure having you on the show and to get your insights of what you saw in Fiji and how. Just to show to listeners that impressions of people who have been there are far better than the impressions or the reckons of a media face that hasn't been there for a number of years.
All good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Denny. It was appreciated that. All too often we find our views are formed by media organisations and not from any real perspective by people on the ground. Affected by events or issues. And that's why I decided to bring Danny on the show. It's great we can have people like Danny Sims on the show to highlight issues like this from a more real, even if it is anecdotal, perspective. Tell me your thoughts on what Danny had to say by emailing inbox@realitycheck.radio or text to 2057.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.